Hi there, you're listening to CITR 101.9, and that was the tail end of Give Him the Boot. And this is Bezneric Rhyme, and my name's Linda. And for those of you who've heard us before, we're a poetry show. The idea is that every week we take one poem by a poet, and the poet and I do the thing in the poem. This week I'm going to be playing an older one, which is with Ken Babstock. And unfortunately, just because he was visiting town, we didn't really have the chance to go do something. So this is more of a straight-up interview, but we did focus on one poem in specific. So for those of you who aren't familiar with Ken Babstock's work, this poem that we're going to be discussing comes out of his third book, Airstream Land Yacht from Anansi, that came out in 2006. And he was this year a nominee for the Governor General's Award. And yeah, he's a neat guy, so enjoy.
A setting two. Get that aside. Just shift it. Ready? And that. Clear away. Can you see? I don't care. It's old. Back in. No, back in behind. We'll cut it away. From here to about here. Not deep, so it can pull away. Go ahead. I'll hold. Fingers. Fingers. Jesus. Keep on. Back in, maybe arm's length. In by the piping. Okay, now just tear. This'll come out. Pry it. It'll snap. There, now clear. Just heave it out. Will it stay? Or prop it? Jam it up against that. See? Then, well, undo all of them. Old ones, scrap. Crumble like this, or damp, all this gack. Drag it out, and I'll scrape. That. We'll go at that. Here, go. Aim, and halfway. It should just there. Now yank. No, down. Now, see? See what I told you?
Thank you. Yeah, a lot of things are definitely clarified about that poem when you hear it read.
Okay, okay, that's...
In terms of stuff like the line, I don't care, it's old. Because when you read it, it's, well, I don't care, it's old.
Right.
And there's a bit of a pause. When you see it on the page, it has that meaning, and it also has the sort of meaning, well, I don't care that it's old. Also the line, that will go at that.
Yeah.
And it's not clear when you see it on the page whether it's with the sense of to go at something in terms of, like, to attack something.
Yeah, yeah, this is interesting. I think there's almost a whole genre or a subgenre now of it poems, you know,
right.
Poems where the gesture of pointing, it or that or this, is left untended to, and that's kind of where the power of it comes from, because there's, we feel that there's a something there. I mean, just sort of metaphysically, inside us, outside us, whatever it is, there's something that you can point to. And in this case, the poem itself, the framing of the poem is set up so that it's almost like overhearing a voice hard at work on something, you know, in the midst of labor. You know, given that framework, they could be work, that is whatever they're tearing away at, a wall. What are they doing? I don't know. You know, they're deconstructing something, reconstructing it, demolishing something, or they're surgeons in a theater of surgery sort of thing, working on a corpse. So whatever, or not a corpse. I mean a human
I'm
patient.
I'm telling all the surgeons I know.
So it was meant to be readable in that context, but then also the way poems can kind of shift out of context and start talking about something else.
Definitely, you get the sense that the it and the that, they start out as one thing, and by the end you aren't sure whether it's the same thing even within that same poem or whether it's become something else. Do you get the sense that the speaker at all times knows what that or it or them is?
No. We were just talking about defining your terms. A lot of times in human communication, when you were just saying something about two people having a conversation and they seem to be going in loops, and usually this gets kind of Wittgensteinian or something, but it's usually about not defining their terms. They're not playing the same language game, you know? They haven't agreed on what it is that they're talking about, whether it's love, money, hope, all those things that are terribly abstract. If you don't define your terms, human conversation can be happening between two aliens. You know, they're not talking about the same thing. So it's like that, where I wanted a poem that happens in the real, that is frameable and seeable in everyday life, but then what the human speaker is saying in that context can seem to become metaphor. Just given that it's on the page in a book of poems, it can be read metaphorically, like, what is it, what is that? Because the poem kind of ends with that sense of threat. threat, like something has gone wrong. Now what? You know, now what's going on? So that can be read in all kinds of kind of metaphorical ways, yeah.
That's something I wondered about as well with the last line and a half. Now yank, no down, no see. See what I told you? When I read it to myself, I sort of thought, it could be a sort of angry see what I told you, or it could be a sort of discovery see. To me, the place where the poem turns or has the potential to turn was in line 9 at tear, in the piping, okay, now just tear. When you said earlier, like, it could be they're constructing something, it could be that they're deconstructing something, I was tempted to read the last as that they had found something unexpected, and that was the see.
This was another one of those poems that was more about discovering where the poem went. Like, the poem happened as I was working on it. I had the voice in my head very easily, because it's a bit of a voice experiment, but I had that voice in my head because, you know, I remember working on a lot of work sites where the gaffer or the... They seem to be giving you directions, what they want you to do, but they're not perfectly clear. You know, they sort of assume that you know how to do something before you know how to do it. So they're saying, just do it, just do it. No, not that way, that way. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's this struggle to keep up with a lack in communication while they need this physical labor, this actual material to be manipulated.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So I had that voice in my head of a human trying to help another human along and direct them, but in fact they're not communicating. And then that the word tear, it's the first sort of instance of violence, or the first time it sounds like violence. So they're acting upon the world, and so something's always at risk, or something always hangs in the balance when you act on the world, you know? And in this case, I think when it gets to see what I told you, it's both ways. It's like, see, I warned you this was going to happen. Or maybe the voice in the poem has surprised itself, because we convince ourselves that we're metaphysically on top of things even when we're not. Mm. See what I told you? He's actually saying to himself, oh my God, I didn't know this was happening. You know what I mean? Yeah.
Two things, I guess, for me about that. With the title, A Setting 2, I initially got a sense of argument, the sense of a set to, the sense of do this, do that, no, not like this, not like that. As the poem wore on, I noticed a lot of sort of partnership language, like, you drag, I'll scrape, go ahead, I'll hold. Maybe you could speak to that, like the relationship between the sort of combative, directional relationship and how that implies partnership.
Yeah, this is that's a great question, really. It is. Like I said, the poem started to kind of inform me of what it was doing after I had just started it as a kind of a voice experiment. I just wanted to see what would happen to writing that voice that I'd heard, you know, over a long period in my life. So I just started in the voice, and then working on the poem, what I liked about it, what the poem did that convinced me that it was worth keeping, was that because there's some sort of communication, you're overhearing one voice talking to another, so there are two figures or agents involved in the poem. But then again, if you want to read it metaphorically, it started to look like some of Samuel Beckett's drama, where there are two figures on stage and they're talking to each other, or one is talking to the other, or whatever, and they are two human figures on stage, but there's always this possibility in his drama that it's the self talking to the self.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? And
yeah,
the splitting that happens inside, and it's sort of how we get by in the world, is to talk to ourselves, to tell ourselves stories and whatnot. But then where's the split, and who's talking to who, and who's in there listening? So I know what you mean. There was that duality in the poem, but the fact that the other figure in the poem doesn't ever speak, I kind of left, because I did have, at one point I was working on answers and a dialogue, but I just thought, no, there's a figure implicit who's hearing all this, but who's that? Who might that be?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I'm interested to see that you think of it wholly as overheard conversation, because when I read it, I assumed it was addressed to, it was sort of an invitational that it was addressed to the reader.
That's a good point, because it, I don't know, it brings up, you know, intention for the poem, you know, how much direction have you given the reader? Because obviously always, whenever a poem uses the you, sometimes it's you, the self, you know, you're talking to the ideal self or to God or to the loved one, but always, no matter what relationship is set up there, always the poems that use you, it is an invitation to the reader. It's partly speaking directly to the reader, but the reader makes that shift where I am the you being talked to, but I'm also not the you being talked to.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really warm kind of way. I mean, this poem in itself is a little bit combative, but the you is always a kind of a warm embrace of the reader, like come in really close and overhear what's going on. So that's there just given the you of the poem. But in this case, it was like come in close and overhear something breaking down a little, you know, overhear communication that's not working and something's at stake and something's lost at the end or something.
This, I know, Because one of the things that I know is sort of underlying the whole this sort of philosophies of mind thing that you've been reading about and been working on.
Yeah, half understanding. Yeah.
Sure. Yeah. Like everybody,
yeah,
you know.
Exactly.
And I guess that's where I saw when you say you were halfway picturing it as workers working on a construction site and halfway as surgeons. I'm wondering if also it was partly scientists pursuing that explanatory gap, pursuing that philosophy of mind.
Yeah. In fact, I didn't have a very important view of that poem. I kind of felt like it might sit between two things and whatnot. And it was my editor, Chiku, who said, no, listen, this section that it's in, it's at the end of the land section where materialism kind of has its day. And there are some poems in that section that are very, very constructed as opposed to, I mean, I'm thinking of the found poems and the, you know, so those very kind of constructed materialist seeming poems. That's where that impulse or that idea kind of has its day in the book. And so to place that setting too at the end of that section, it kind of implicitly asks, okay, if consciousness is explained, like let's just assume for a minute that we're 30 years down the road and it's all been completely explained and it's still a beautiful and glorious thing in the world, human consciousness, but we now understand fully how it comes to arise.
Right.
And it is just all brain function. Now what? Now what? Does it mean anything? Does it mean nothing? I think it does have huge implications, you know, for ethics and for philosophy and all that. But it's not that we're going to feel any different. You know what I mean? It's not like we're going to feel as if things have changed. Well, we do feel differently when reading this. I mean, I felt hugely differently, but it's not going to change who we are. So what is the effect of this having happened?
Yeah.
So I like the question at the end of the section, you know, kind of just ask, assume this to be true, now what? And so when Chiku suggested putting it at the end of the section, I thought that makes perfect sense. You know, that's where you get a little help from your editor.
Right. That, I guess, was something I wondered about this poem in specific, whether there's something in the structure of the poem itself that is supposed to imply that sense of having no sort of core interior self, but having a collection of things that sort of surround an emptiness or surround a thing which should be there, which we assume is there, but which is not in fact there.
The action, what's going on in the poem, this peeling away of materials and kind of clobbering your way to the center and then getting to the center and some damage having been done. I guess in a way the poem enacts the feeling of reading this stuff, reading about consciousness, you know, because there's nothing more fascinating than reading about the
your ability
entity
to read.
In the world that is reading the book. So it's really fascinating stuff and it's really fun, but it can be scary. For some reason, something feels like it's being threatened. And so you have to ask yourself, well, what is it in me that feels threatened by this stuff? So I guess, the poem, it is like a little play, like I mentioned Beckett earlier, trying to enact or put on stage the feeling of wrestling with this material, this materiality, and trying to get to the center where you can affect something, fix it or change it or put a new one in or take out the old one or whatever.
Like it's a light bulb.
Yeah, like it's a light bulb or something. But then you get to the center and there's nothing there or something has been damaged. Or in the process of getting there, or you know, I think it's an open-ended poem because when I start to think about it, I get all sad. You know, I don't know what, because I don't know, I don't really know where I stand. Like I can say I'm 99% convinced of materialist, like a materialist view of philosophy and the mind, but then there's something that gets terribly sad when I talk about. You know, it's it's odd.
It's like heavy, really like affecting stuff. Yeah. That's something I wanted to talk about as well. Is sort of that sense of damage, and what you're talking about, because it is an addressed to someone poem, and it has that sort of damaging capacity. I wanted to talk about relationship with a reader, because these are ideas that when you read about them, it's something that upsets you, right? And whether you feel like there's a sense of combat, I guess, this is not something that people want to necessarily think or feel, especially when they are the type of people who want to read lyric poetry and want to think about themselves as having this interior self in a really strong way. And I'm wondering what you think, sort of, whether it's a warm relationship with the you in this poem, or whether it's a bit like, I'm going to shake you up with this fact that I think you need to think about.
Right, yeah. The last thing I would want to be seen as is being on some sort of crusade to convince someone, you know, because that's just not the job of art. That's just not what, and I don't think it's what the book's trying to do. But certainly, I mean, I think this is all hooked into an old idea that I agree with, that there is no art or thinking. Those two things, if we can just sort of smash them up into one right now, there is no art or thinking without pain.
Right.
I mean, there's pleasure, obviously. That's how we first get to art is the pleasure principle, but there is no pleasure. There isn't such a thing without pain. So any art or thinking, I think, that can be called that, that's worthy of the name, there is a destabilizing, even if it's very slight, that there's no pleasure without its flip side, which is pain. You know, it hurts. It wasn't easy after the First World War when modernism hit. People didn't embrace that with open arms because it advanced humanity, and you could feel it advancing humanity. You know, it felt more like an absolute violation of their, how the hell did humanity get here, and how,
right.
We're going to have to think pretty freaking hard, and the art is going to have to do some serious business to get anywhere.
Peaches and roses.
Yeah, like I said, the invitation to the reader to come in and listen to Let's Do This Together, that's the warmth of it, is that there would be no writing without the implied you, the reader. So obviously we're trying to do this together, and that's the invitation to come and do with Let's Go Along Together. But the trip that the reader and the writer are making isn't necessarily meant to calm us and reassure us.
Right.
I think sort of the opposite.
I'm going to ask you about something that you said in an interview you did recently with Kevin Chong for the Globe and Mail. I kind of wanted to ask, because, like, you know, your poems are the kind of poems that do need to be sat with and read over and over to get a sense of kind of what's going on. And I guess I want to ask how much you feel you have a right to demand of a reader in terms of effort that they're going to put in. To me, it seems like there's the question of, like, how many times do you think someone needs to read this poem to get to, maybe not exactly where you're going, but get somewhere near what you're trying to say. And then there's sort of, how many times do you think it's reasonable to expect people to do that?
Mm-hmm. This is really naughty, quite naughty, as in K-N-O-T-T-Y, okay. Question. And I wish I was David Foster Wallace, because he has been asked that very question,
sure.
And he's dealt with it so beautifully. And I would agree with his first step that it's not that it's limitless. You know, I would never say, I can do whatever the hell I want, and you can either come along or not. There's something deeply arrogant in that. And Wallace, when he was answering that question, pointed back to elements in his work that he would change now, you know? I'm going to get this wrong, and I don't know what the point is of paraphrasing David Foster Wallace, because I'm not him, but there is a negotiation that you make with yourself, because the reader's not there in there when you're making the thing. I mean, they're there imaginarily, so there's a negotiation you make with yourself / the reader that's present, where you're just sort of making a contract. I'm not going to do anything gratuitous, self-absorbed, meaningless. I'm not going to take you for a ride and waste your time. I'm going to try really hard. I'm going to make an honest effort. So if you will too, then hopefully this will get somewhere. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I love reading stuff that's over my head, you know, that I can feel it zipping by, and I'm going, oh my God, I'm missing it all. but those are the writers I go back to, because I think they work that hard, there's something there. And there's nothing more violent than going back and finding nothing there, you know, that you feel deeply cheated. So it's just sort of a negotiation, like a kind of contract that you make inside yourself. I'm willing to get involved if you are, and there's no guarantee, but I'm not going to cheat you deliberately or something.
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
I want you to put in work, but I swear to God, there's something for you at the end, you know?
Yeah. It's like I just propositioned you. Didn't it?
I don't think so.
I don't mean proposition. I just mean a proposition for a long relationship. Do you know what I mean? As I was saying it, I was thinking it's kind of the agreement that two people make when they enter into a long relationship. Like we'll give it a shot, and it takes a lot of work, but at the outset, I don't plan to deceive. I don't plan to cheat.
Yeah.
So there's that kind of,
you
enter into a relationship.
Faith.
Yeah, it's like doing it in good faith. Yeah, so
yeah.
Whatever that means.
Yeah, I mean, because like a lot of people perceive poetry as a bit of a sleight of hand, right? It's sort of like, I'm going to say something that sounds really complicated, but really it's quite simple, you know?
Yeah, and I chuck the poetry book across the room when I find that. Do you know what I mean? If I feel like there's a sleight of hand going on, and the lines sound important, sound reverential, but at bottom
there's
empty, that false weight. I'm the first one to throw the poetry book across the room, so I know what the reader feels like, because I'm a reader.
I didn't actually bring up the quote from Kevin Chong's article, which was, if a reader gets something on the first read-through, it's an imaginative colonization of the poem. And I puzzled over that, and I wasn't entirely sure what I was going to make that out to mean. So if you want to help me out, that would be great.
Yeah, I probably didn't contextualize that very well, but I meant that if art of any kind is so utterly instantaneously digestible and knowable, that kind of knowing where it does not disturb anything, you go into the experience in a certain state, and you come out of the experience in the exact same state, and the art has passed you by, not passed you by, but you've taken in the so-called art, and you know it, and now it's gone. It's kind of a control mechanism, like, now I get it. It took me 30 seconds, I get it, I understand it, now dispose of it. So there's this, like, creeping, there's this quality of human intelligence where it's creeping out, colonizing, and moving on, you know, the westward push,
right,
sort of
like
thing.
It's sort like, of like an ownership.
Yeah, exactly.
Thing.
So I think the best qualities of art are the things that resist that easy knowing.
Right, like it puts up a bit of a fight.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
That's what I was trying to say. Just like to say hi to Phil, who was my boss, who I worked with for many years here in Vancouver doing renovations. And he was a great guy, big reader, lover of books, and we used to have great conversations while we were swinging the hammer.
Awesome. Well, thank you, Phil. You have made this all possible. All right, that was an interview that I did with Ken Babstock, and his book that comes from, Airstream Land Yacht, is available from Anansi. And I hope that you enjoyed this episode of Bezneric Rhyme, and you're listening to CITR 101.9. And I'm just going to make a small announcement, which is that at this week's Robson Reading Series, there's going to be Carla Funk, who's Victoria's current poet laureate, and who also teaches in the creative writing department at UVic. And she'll be reading from her recent collection, The Sewing Room, from Turnstone Press. Then also Stephen Price is going to be there reading, and I think I mentioned him before. He has a book out from Brick Books called... I can't remember what it's called suddenly, but it's about Houdini. And Anatomy of Keys. Sorry. So it's a really interesting book. It's a book of poetry about Houdini. So you should go and check that out. That'll be happening at Robson Square at 7 p.m. this Thursday, the 19th. And all right, thanks for listening to my show. And actually, next week is going to be our last show. It's time for, bit of a move. So tune in next week at the same time and stay tuned for Reel to Reel.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Reel to Reel at the Movies. Robert Waldman back.